Religion and politics don't mix very well. They never have mixed very well, and I suspect they won't in the future either. The Old Testament prophets, well, it's a checkered career of them ticking off kings and being ticked off by kings. Indeed, the Old Testament prophets have a fairly bad track record in terms of long life. Even when you come to the New Testament, you kick off with John the Baptist, who loses his head at the hands of a Herod, one of the forefathers of a man that we read of tonight. Jesus himself is persecuted by the state and executed by the government in the end. And through the 2,000 years of Christian history, there has been one bad scene after another as Christians have been involved with governments. Sometimes some of the government fights have been religious fights. Sometimes some of the governments have been anti-religious in their fighting. But rarely have we been able to come to any happy resolution of the relationship that should exist between our faith and the government. Even today, there are Christians in many parts of the world who are suffering at the hands of governments. I think we must be particularly mindful of the Christians and prayerful of the Christians in Iran, for we hear much of the American hostages, but we hear little of the Christian hostages who have been held by the government in Iran and will not be released by that government. There are three Church Missionary Society missionaries who are at that moment, in this moment, held in captivity in Iran and have been for the past 6 months or so. One of them, a Scottish lady who was the secretary of the bishop, had actually been shot prior to her captivity. We haven't really heard from her for several months now. The bishop's family has been exiled. The bishop's son was murdered. Christians, you see, are still today undergoing the same kinds of problems that we've seen in centuries. And the tensions between religious groups and state groups can be seen in all kinds of places. The Philippines, Korea, South Africa, Spain, the underground church that's behind the Iron Curtain, even the present Polish dispute has a lot to do with a religious group seeking to fight against that of the government. What we desire in government, we almost all agree with. That is, we want to see government where the land is ruled in godliness and righteousness and truth and justice and equity. But we do not see that kind of government anywhere in the world. What we desire is God's government. And while every government of the world has been appointed by God, we do not see godliness in government, but rather sinfulness. Because governments are a strange mixture of the human and the divine, appointed by God, but very human. Appointed by God to rule under his authority, but frequently ruling in opposition to his authority, and ruling indeed as if they were God. Now in chapter 12, we see of the book of Acts, we see the conflict between the state and the Christians in the apostles' day. We see the murder of James, the imprisonment of Peter, and the death of Herod. There are seven Herods in the New Testament, so don't panic yourself as to why this one's still alive when the other one was around and so forth. I mean, one of them was alive when Jesus was born, and this is some many years later. On the first reading of it, the whole events of chapter 12 sound extraordinary. The angel releasing Peter from the prison, the king cut down in a stroke from the angel. And we as modern readers are a little bit puzzled by it. If we're unbelievers, we say, oh, the New Testament, it's full of angels. Kind of like fairy stories that take place. It's kind of strange, it's bizarre, it's nothing like life is lived. I mean, there's many a time, many an Australian politician, I would love to have been cut down by an angel, but it doesn't happen much these days. And if we're believers, we may agree with that last sentiment, but we'll tend to say, well, that's what it says, that's what happened. But it is a bit strange. And for some of us as believers, it's a bit worrying. Yet what happens is not so extraordinary. It's very ordinary, really. Look at verses 12 to 17, for example, where Peter comes knocking on the door and Rhoda won't let him in. That is a marvellously ordinary story. It is so true to life, isn't it? It's so humorous. It's so uncontrived. Who would have thought up that little incident, that little episode? And having thought it up, recorded it, doesn't bring credit on Rhoda. It doesn't bring credit on Peter. It doesn't bring credit, actually brings discredit on the people inside praying. But it's just what life's like. It's full of those kind of anecdotes. As I was travelling back in the plane this afternoon from Dubbo, the lady next to me was telling me the story about her husband walking into a plate glass door and breaking his nose. At the time, he was entertaining or just met up with a doctor. And he was been chatting to this doctor. He'd only just met the man. He didn't know much about him other than he was a doctor. And he was talking to him. He was a migrant, actually, from South America. And he was just getting himself established in medicine here in Australia and getting all the necessary acceptance and the like. And this man, this husband, you see, walks into the plate glass door and nose bleeding profusely, as noses are wont to when they're under such pressure. And he came back to the doctor trying to stop it all up. He said, "Look what's happened, look what's happened." And the doctor says, "No, no, I'm a gynecologist." And he said, it's so real, isn't it? I mean, you don't make up stories like that. I mean, that is the kind of thing that happens. And that doctor has become a great friend of the family, and they always joke with him about it. But what use is a gynecologist? Now, that kind of event of life is not the kind of event of life that you make up, but it's the event of life which is real. When you hear it, you say, "Yeah, I can just imagine that happening." And that's what it's like here in 12 to 17, isn't it? You can just imagine Rhoda saying, "Oh, look, it's Peter," slam, and racing upstairs. And you can just imagine Peter down the front, not wanting to make too much noise to arouse attention, but desperately wanting to get in and knocking away furiously. And you can imagine the people upstairs saying, "Oh, cut it out, it's ridiculous, it wasn't." The whole thing is real and uncontrived and unimportant, and yet put in this story. It's a very ordinary story. But you say, "Ah, Philip, what about angels?" Well, friends, it's a little problem for us, but the word angel, angelos in Greek, is the word for messenger. And when it is used in non-religious contexts, it always means a messenger. You get someone to run down and buy some milk, he's an angel. He's a messenger. He goes and does a message for it. It's a normal, everyday, household Greek word, which means messenger. When you put it into a religious context, we're never sure whether it's going to be a winged, spirity kind of messenger, or it's going to be a human kind of messenger. And so we tend to say, "Well, let's keep it angel," and then that leaves it open. The only trouble is all of you and I think when as soon as we use angel are those six winged creatures that go floating around the world. See, with two wings covering their feet, and two wings they fly, and two wings they cover their face, and they never bump into each other. Now, that bunch of angel kind of beings is what we think of immediately, but the word is messenger. And there is no need to translate it any other way than messenger. On both occasions, a messenger comes to Peter. He may have been human. He may not have been human. I'm not saying he's not, but there's no reason to think of it other than human. A human messenger it may have been. A messenger he was, or she was, or it was, but a messenger need not be a supernatural being. It could have just been a good old-fashioned jailbreak. That's what it may have been. And a very ordinary one than that. As indeed, what is the messenger that strikes down Herod? And so, you can read the event and not come to such strange, extraordinary, supernatural feelings about it. That's more than that. In Freddie Bruce's commentary on the Book of Acts, which I held up to you because if you're going to buy commentaries on the Book of Acts, that's a good one to buy. It's an excellent commentary by F.F. Bruce. It's a bit old now. It's written 20 or so years ago. But it really is very good. F.F. Bruce on the Book of Acts. He recounts an event in the life of Sudhar Singh. I don't know how to pronounce his name. And all of you who know Hindi or whatever it is that comes on will apologise my broad Australian accent as I say Sudhar Singh. Now, he was a Sikh. Who lived at the turn of the century, disappeared in 1929. He was converted to Christianity in 1902 and became quite a famous evangelist amongst Tibetan people. He travelled to the West and he couldn't stand Christianity in the West because it was all so materialistic. and so returned to Tibet, where he preached the gospel fearlessly and faithfully for many years until he disappeared. However, we read of an event that took place in his life, which is accounted in many books and many occasions. That's an extraordinary event. By the order of the chief lama of a certain Tibetan community, he was thrown into a dry well, and the lid was securely locked. Here he was left to die, like many others before him, whose bones and rotting flesh lay at the bottom of the well. On the third night, when he had been crying to God in prayer, he heard someone unlocking the lid of the well and removing it, and then a voice spoke, telling him to take hold of the rope that was being lowered. He did so. He was glad to find a loop at the bottom of the rope in which he could place his foot, for his arm had been injured when he was thrown down. And he was then drawn up. The lid was replaced and locked. But when he looked around to thank his rescuer, he could find no trace of him. When morning came, he returned to the city where he had been arrested and resumed preaching. News was brought to the lama that the man who had been thrown into the execution well for preaching had been liberated and was preaching again. Sundar Singh was brought before him and questioned and told the story of his release. The lama declared that someone must have got hold of the key and let him out. But when search was made for the key, it was found attached to the lama's own girdle. Now, says one commentator who wrote this story up in 1925, but a commentator on the Book of Acts, although this story is in our own time, its interpretation is as difficult as the story of St. Peter's escape. It is possible that both escapes were non-miraculous, that some well-disposed person acted as a rescuer. But the difficulty in the way of rescue in either case suggests that both were actually miraculous interventions of God. One striking difference between the two accounts is the opinion of the prisoner at the time. St. Peter thought it was a vision until he found himself safe and sound. The sadhu thought that the rescuer was a man until he disappeared. It, in some sense, is an ordinary event. You can explain it without any reference to miraculous, can't you? Even the key around the lama's girdle, you can explain, can't you? I mean, he wasn't released by a man owning the key, but by someone who could pick a lock. I understand some people can do such a thing. Have a grandmother-in-law who's not bad at it. Now, you can explain the thing just ordinarily. The messenger being maybe no more than that. Or again, the case of Herod's death. At first count, it sounds extraordinary. But then Josephus was a Jewish historian of the first century. And Josephus wrote about the death of Herod, the self-same Herod. And Josephus is writing after the Book of Acts, I think. I believe it's after the Book of Acts, but certainly independently of the Book of Acts. No one has any suggestion that they are in any way related. Josephus, not a Christian in any sense, may not have been acquainted with the writings of Luke at all. And this is what Josephus says concerning the death of Agrippa. He exhibited shows in honour of Caesar, inaugurating a festival for the emperor's welfare. And there came together to this festival a large number of the provincial officials and others of distinguished position. And on the second day of the shows, Agrippa put on a robe made of silver throughout, and of altogether wonderful weaving, and entered the theatre at the break of day. Then the silver shone and glittered wonderfully as the sun's first rays fell on it, and its resplendence inspired a sort of fear and trembling in those who gazed on it. Immediately his flatterers called out from the various directions, using language which boded him no good, for they addressed him as a god, and invoked him with a cry, "Be gracious unto us! Hitherto we have reverenced thee as a man, but henceforth we acknowledge thee to be of more than mortal nature." He did not rebuke them, nor did he repudiate their impious flattery. But soon afterwards, he looked up and saw an owl sitting on a rope above his head, and immediately recognized it as a messenger of evil, as it had on a former occasion been a messenger of good. And a pang of grief pierced his heart. At the same time, he was seized by a severe pain in his belly, which began with a most violent attack. He was carried quickly into the palace, And when he had suffered continuously for 5 days from the pain in his belly, he died in the 54th year of his age and the 7th year of his reign. That's a remarkably similar account of what we have in front of us, isn't it? It is substantially the same thing. It all sounded like a fairy story to you. There's not a historian in the world who wouldn't be accepting what Josephus is saying. And Josephus got no particular grudge to bear one way or another. He has particularly, but wouldn't relate to this matter. Josephus is not making up a story. There are enough differences in the story to know that the two have not got together and cooked it up. And there's no reference to the owl here, is there? The owl you'll find in Josephus' story, there was a warning given to Herod that the next time he saw an owl sitting over his head, that he would die in 5 days. So Josephus' owl incident's got to do with Josephus' writing, it may be true. And it's interesting, I read the word messenger here in the text, because that's what's here in front of us, but if you check out the Greek of Josephus, you'll find that the word is angel. It's the same word. It's just that when you don't have it in the Bible, you usually don't translate it angel, you usually translate it messenger, but you could translate it angel, except that it was an owl, and you know that an owl's not an angel, is it? So therefore, we don't translate it as an angel. See the kind of problem we have in how we make it more supernatural than it need be. And how the historical evidences we have are actually saying the same thing as the scripture is saying at this point. The man was proclaimed to be God by his surrounding peoples. And instead of repudiating it, he accepted it. He immediately got sick and shortly thereafter died in some considerable pain. The nature of his illness and the like, I don't know. But clearly his contemporaries saw it as a judgment upon him. So then, these things may seem ordinary. Oh no, they're not ordinary, they're actually extraordinary. They are really something else. Because the messengers, be they humans or owls or winged spirits or whatever, the messengers are the messengers of God. We must never reduce Christianity or the Bible to merely this world. It's fundamentally about God's involvement in the affairs of this world, God's intervention in the affairs of this world. It's got to do with the other world breaking into this world. If you reduce Christianity just to the affairs of this world, then you reduce it just to morality. Not that. It's actually something far greater than that. It is God's affairs in the affairs of men. There is a supernatural immediacy here. God sends his messengers to do his tasks, releasing Peter on one hand, cutting down Herod on the other hand, answering people's prayers. It's all about the supernatural involvement in the natural world that we have here. It is extraordinary. Is extraordinary. Now, while this chapter not only indicates the strange mixture of what you call divine history, a strange mixture of things that are both ordinary and extraordinary at the same time, it also illustrates three basic principles of the Bible. That is, when you look at chapter 12, you can see it as events that are both ordinary and extraordinary. And that helps us in understanding the nature of the gospel of Jesus, the nature of the Bible, that we will see things both natural and supernatural, all jumbled up together, because we see God involved in the affairs of men. But the chapter is written, I think, to illustrate to us these other principles of God's ways of involving in men's affairs. And there are three that I've pointed to tonight. The power and persecution of the state, the prayer and protection of people, and the pride and punishment of God. And you'll be relieved to know that I didn't waste too much time thinking up all the P's. They came to me almost immediately. Well, very promptly. Now, firstly, the power and persecution of the state. For we are warned throughout Scripture that men will persecute those who stand firm for the gospel of Jesus Christ. And, of course, men in government are men who are in power. They have the power to execute their persecutions with great speed and efficiency. Thus, the state is always a potential threat to Christians. even though the state is appointed by God, it has great potential threat to Christians. As we read in the Psalm tonight, Psalm 146, the psalmist says, do not put your trust in princes, but put your trust in God. It's a great temptation to us to trust and rely upon the government to look after us, to protect us, to care for us. We're tempted to tune in here in Australia. We think, oh, things can't really go wrong. They can't really bash us up in the streets. We have got a sound government. We have got laws and rules and rights in our legislation. Things cannot go wrong here as they have in, and then you can list out every other country you wish to. It's a fool's paradise. We must not trust governments to protect us. State power relies on popularity. And look what happens in verse 2. Herod finds that the Jews are pleased with him when he starts persecuting Christians. And therefore, he sets to. When the time comes that a politician finds out that he can be popular by burning Christians in Australia, he will start doing it. Politician will do anything for popularity. That's what gives him the power. Now, it may not be burning, it sounds so antiquarian today. It just may be legislating against them in other levels, in other ways. But do not trust governments, for they are only sinful men plus power. Now, I'm not suggesting this is going to happen today or tomorrow in Australia, but we must continue to pray for our governments that they will rule in justice and equity and truth. And we mustn't trust them that they will do that. Not that we're to fear them, as I'll explain in a moment, but we must beware of them. All governments, everywhere. Some Christians, you see, actually think that they will be able to bring in godliness by bringing in governments. It is a sad mistake to think that you are advancing the kingdom of God either by voting Mr. Reagan or Mr. Carter. Mustn't put your trust, I haven't done it on the Australian scene, I thought it would be safer on the American. Mustn't trust governments for godliness. Pray for them for that. Hope for it. Long for it. But persecution is the way of sinful men. And governments are made up of sinful men with power. But there's no need to fear them because of the second thing. That is prayer and the protection of people. But you'll notice how in this chapter the people pray, verse 5, so Peter was in prison, and the church was earnestly praying to God for him. And down in verse 12, it looks like they're praying all night. For when this had dawned on Peter, he went to the house of Mary and the mother of John, also called Mark, where many people had gathered and were praying. I mean, the fellas in prison had all fallen asleep. I presume it was fairly late at night at that stage of the game. And the people were up there praying in the upper room somewhere. And God protected Peter, rescued him and saved him as he did Daniel in the day of old. God protected Peter, released him. Yet, there are strange anomalies in it, aren't there? Because James was not protected. In verse 1 and 2, James is killed. God's not promised to protect everybody from persecution. In fact, in Mark chapter 10, you find that James, Jesus predicted, would face that kind of death. You say, well, does that mean praying has no effect? I say, no, praying has much effect. Listen to the tapes on prayer that we went through of recent times. But you mustn't think that you can coerce God by prayer into doing anything that is contrary to his will. If it is his will and plan, then in praying to God, you are turning the matter over to God. And if God's time for you is now, well then you will go now, and that's all there is to it. God listens and heeds the prayers of his people. But we cannot order God in prayer. And there's another anomaly in it too. Though the believers were praying, they didn't believe, did they? Extraordinary. There they are up all night praying for Peter to be rescued. Peter comes knocking on the door. Oh no, it couldn't be Peter. I mean, he's in prison. We all know where he is. No way in the world could it be Peter.
Now, what kind of believing prayer is that prayer?
Well, it is sufficient believing prayer to see him released.
But it's insufficient to actually believe it when it happens. Isn't that like you've got a book that's been written about the truth? See, the story's not polished up any, is it? The people are made, not made to look like greater saints than they are or something or other. The Christians are just like you and me. We pray for things, but we can't in the life of us see how they could be answered. And we don't really know about it. Now, there are some Christians around today who say that if you can't believe it, then God won't give it to you. Well, here's a great example where they didn't believe it, and yet God did give it to them. It's not the size of your faith which counts. Mustard seeds move mountains, if you remember. Sycamore trees and the like. No, it's not the size of your faith that counts. And you can be in great conundrum about it. So I don't know how it can happen. I can't really even see that you could do it. But God, please do it. And when it happened, well, I reckon there was a lot of singing praises of God that night. And the third thing that you see illustrated in this chapter is the pride and punishment of God. That is, here is Herod with his overweening pride. Here is a real rebellion against God, isn't it? I am God. This cannot be tolerated by the one who is God. And therefore he is cut down. And here surely is a clear warning for us all. For all sin is rebellion against God, and those who are living outside of Jesus Christ are living a life of rebellion. They are saying, Christ isn't going to run my life. I'm running my life. I am in control of my affairs. They are implying, although they most likely would not express it in such terms, I am God, for I run my life. Well, who do you think you are if you think you run your life? You think you are God, at least the God of you. It is the rejection of the God of the world. And look what happens to Herod when he accepts the acclamation of the people that he is God. So where do we fit into this chapter? Firstly, our attitude to the state is illustrated here. We're not to trust them, although we needn't fear them. We don't trust them because as sinful people they will do what Herod did when popularity demands it. No point trusting them, for they will ultimately persecute us. But we needn't fear them, because our true citizenship is not Australia, it is the kingdom of heaven. And God protects his people as he sees fit. He is the king of the king. He is the ruler of the ruler and the Lord of the Lord. And we need not be afraid of men. The tension, therefore, friends, will always remain between Christians and the state. It will remain because the state will not like us, and it will remain because we will not bow down to the state and worship it, as in the days of Daniel. We'll always be saying to the government, you must not do that. It is against God. It is against righteousness. There is no way the state will ever enjoy us doing that. No government is ever going to be happy to have Christians standing up and declaring what is right. There will always be tensions between Christians and their government. And the lack of tension in Australia may have nothing to do with the good government we have here, but have to do with the weak Christians. You need to ponder that sometime. Especially those of you who don't think the government's not so crash hot. So my citizenship is the first thing that brings to my attention. The second is my prayers. For as God released Peter, so he may release our friends. I don't know how that may happen, but it may. It may be an extraordinary and miraculous thing. It may be just a change in government that doesn't seem extraordinary and miraculous. But I know God can if it is his will. And therefore I need to plead with him for his will. I met a man in Sydney some months ago, a year or so ago now. Must be more than that, because it was the time when Idi Amin was still in control. And who had come from Uganda, one of our refugees. And he told me how he'd been thrown into prison, into the execution camp of Idi Amin. And yet he was able to stand and tell me the story sometime afterwards. He said he was locked up in a cell in which men had been battered to death.
and their blood was on the walls around about him. And he knew what his fate was. And the morning came for him to be executed, and the guards flung open the gate, the door of his cell, and he was told to go out and run for the open gate across the compound. And he knew that that was the form of execution that was available to him. So he said he got up, and in fear and terror, he walked out as they pushed him along, condoled him along, and they told him to head for the gate. And he said, I do not want to go. And they said, you must go. And so he did. And nobody did anything. They just let him go. Now, he didn't go back and check out why that was so. I'm sure that our inquisitive, educated minds are dying to know why it is so. And I'm also fairly sure we'll never know. God does what God does, when he does, how he does, in ways that are beyond our imagination. You didn't think that was going to happen, did you? And you weren't in the situation. What about our dear friends in Iran? Those three missionaries, the doctor, his wife, and the bishop's secretary. I don't know. I mean, if the American government can't get out there, how can we possibly hope to see our people get out? I don't know. But I suggest that prayer is the way, isn't it? That is the appropriate response for our Christian brothers and sisters who are suffering all around the world at such costs. Continue diligent and earnest in our prayers, even if we see no results, and even if we can't even work out the possibility of results. Keep praying. And thirdly, take the warning of Herod. Beware of rebellion against God, of thinking of yourself as the ruler of your own life, of thinking of yourself as God, or of other people thinking of you as if you were God. Always give God the glory. For to him and to him alone belongs all the glory that could ever come our way.